Journalist Aidan Hartley was born in Kenya just as Africa was finally breaking free of the colonial nations that had sent his parents, grandparents there. When his father died, he discovered a carved wooden chest.
Inside, Aidan Hartley found a lion's skin and a flute made of apricot wood. Botanical studies, plus notes on cattle and camels, dams and irrigation projects, a scheme to allow the nomads to remain free. At the very bottom, he discovered the dust-covered diary of another adventurer, his father's best friend in Arabia. These stories inspired his book, The Zanzibar Chest, and also explain how in the 1990s, young Aidan Hartley found himself a reporter roaming from war to war.
I became a reporter because I wanted to follow in my father's footsteps to the extent that I had believed that he had led a very adventurous life. I had no idea that what I would end up covering would be such suffering and wars and all of the things that happened to the continent during the 1990s.
There's an expression called feed the beast. It most especially applies to wire service reporters, which you were.
When one was working for a wire service, it was all about being completely obsessed by the news. And the image of feeding the beast was that there was this maw that could not be satisfied or filled, and all the trouble in the world you could throw down its neck and it wouldn't be satisfied. That was what engaged me once I got onto the road as a reporter with Reuters, covering conflicts that were coming to a head because the Berlin Wall had come down, riots and people on the streets and the smell of tear gas and the sense of change. And of course we had hopes that we would be able to breathe free, that we would be able to have some sort of second wind of change, if you like. Unfortunately, we ended up covering a litany of disasters.
There's a little passage that is datelined Rwanda, October 1990. It's before the genocide in Rwanda, but it puts on display a sort of surreal quality that threads through your book.
At Gabiro, the president's shooting lodge, casualties are all over the place. Retreating government forces have polished off most of the food, including the pet chimpanzees. Rebel boys are pursuing a white rabbit around the swimming pool. The president left all his crystal and a very fine cellar. I select a bottle and I drink from it as I trampoline on the leader's bed. Outside, a female radio correspondent, my friend Catherine Bond, is interviewing a rebel commander. The booze mixed with fear makes me feel deliciously numb. The hillside below us is on fire and a battle is still in progress. The grass is covered with boots left behind by fleeing peasant boys in the government army who could run faster in bare feet. A child soldier sways after them, swigging from a bottle of claret in one hand and dangling a white rabbit by the ears in the other. "This has to be the biggest story in the world," I say to Catherine. "This is it. We've arrived. The front line."
It gets very much worse when you find yourself in Somalia.
Yes, well, Somalia was something that we didn't have language to describe. And bear in mind that the world's attention was focused on a combination of the First Gulf War and the breakup of the relationship between Prince Charles and Princess Diana. Somalia fell off the map. And I describe going into Mogadishu the day that the dictator, Siad Barre, finally fled the city after having demolished half of it with what artillery he had left. And it was a world turned upside down.
You know, you write about this notion that editors will all say no story is worth dying for.
Well, yes, there's a constant mantra, no story is worth dying for. But of course, if you're 10 miles down the road and you don't get the story, then you don't get what we called the herogram, which was the little service message saying, "Well done, guys." In Somalia, there was a great sense of outrage that we could not, in the early days, get the world to take any notice of what was happening. So I say in the book that, you know, I would set out to write a story that would ruin someone's breakfast because we wanted to make people wake up to it. Why did that happen and why does it continue to happen?
In the end, you've left off being a war correspondent.
Yes, I mean, I tell the story of a boy that I'd called in the book Lazarus, who during a cholera epidemic of refugees who had fled from the genocide in Rwanda to what is now Congo, standing on the edge of a mass grave one morning with a French Foreign Legionnaire, we saw movement down in the bottom of the grave. And we jumped down into the grave, crawled across these bodies, and pulled out from this mass grave a little boy. And the boy, as he told his story to us, had got lost from his mother in the exodus from Rwanda, and then found the body of what he thought was his mother lying dead by the road. And he lay down and hugged her and stayed there until he passed out. And he was taken for dead by the people who were going around collecting the bodies. So we thought that he had been saved, and we took him to a clinic. And that was, for me, the ray of hope. And I went away and I wrote that story, and it was used by editors all over the world. And I went around to the clinic the next day with a bag of candy and looked for him, and the nurse came out to me and shook her head and said, "No, this child decided not to live. He died." And for me, that was the full stop. I couldn't ever imagine myself in news after that. The news out of Africa is not all bad. There are many things happening that are causes for optimism, and it's not for the world to shy away just because there's bad news. It's for the world to engage with those problems, because they're all of our problems.
Aidan Hartley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Aidan Hartley now lives and writes with his family on a farm in Kenya. His book is called The Zanzibar Chest.